Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we're featuring inspiring Appalachian stories, like Jeffrey Cousins, who could have worked anywhere as a heart surgeon, but he came home to West Virginia to practice medicine.
And I think I bring a lot back to West Virginia that other heart surgeons who are not West Virginians can't possibly bring. The understanding that I always tease the patients and I tell them I'm from McDowell County. They said, oh, that's amazing. I speak hillbilly well.
And a West Virginia native once handpicked by the president to lead the Department of Health and Human Services sends a message to youngsters in the state.
It is an incredible thing to be from our state and to be proud of it.
You'll find these inspiring stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Appalachia has produced many noted scientists, doctors, mathematicians, and engineers. And since 2010, West Virginia Public Broadcasting has produced a series of stories called Inspiring West Virginians, highlighting 29 leaders in health, business, and science. On today's episode of Inside Appalachia, we'll hear three of these stories, a kind of finale, because this is the final year of the series. Independent producer Gene Snediger reported these stories with the help of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Suzanne Higgins. After working for the BBC for more than 20 years, in 2002, Snediger returned to her hometown of Elkins, West Virginia, because she missed the mountains and her people. We'll start today's show with the profile of a McDowell County native who also left West Virginia and returned home. Dr. Jeffrey Cousins is a heart surgeon and one of the best heart surgeons in the country, according to his colleagues. Gene Snediger has the story.
So typically, if I have surgery scheduled, I try to get here about 6:30 or a quarter to 7.
Yeah.
And we're going to go to the what we call here the open heart recovery unit. I'm Jeffrey Cousins. I was born in Welch, West Virginia, in the county of McDowell. I'm the youngest of 11 children, and I'm a heart surgeon. By the time I was born, my mom was 46 years old and my dad was 50. And my father had spent about 30 or so years in the coal mines. And so when I was born, his health had already begun to fail him. My mother, on her 11th child, she was having some health issues as well. She developed diabetes, gestational diabetes, which wreaked havoc on her eyes, her kidneys, her heart, and what have you. So I spent a lot of my early years back and forth to doctor's offices and hospitals because of my parents' health. It was somewhat disheartening because we didn't always get any answers when we went to the physician's office or to the hospital. In fact, a lot of times we left the hospital with more questions and confusion than when we showed up.
Dr. Jeffrey Cousins, who's now 42, decided at a very young age that he would one day help the people of West Virginia in a way that he wished his parents had been helped.
Hello. Just wanted to kind of get an update on bed 4. The lady in bed 4, she's an 88-year-old lady who was transferred from Thomas Memorial Hospital here for an emergency bypass surgery because she had had a large heart attack.
Yes.
So this is my little lady here. She promised me when she came in that she was going to walk out of here. She wasn't going to be carried out of here. Each morning I remind her of that. I think she's going to be okay, but I'm praying and pulling and keeping a close eye on her all day, every day. Yes.
This looks like an intensive care unit.
Yes, and it is very intense. It's usually where my first stop is in the morning, and I make several stops throughout the day, and subsequently, you always stop in open heart unit before you go home in the evening.
How does this unit compare to units that you've worked in around the United States?
This is a superior unit. It's very well run. We have some very experienced people here. We've done more heart surgery than most places in the entire world on a yearly basis here for a long time. And that fact of doing so many for such a long time really makes us good at it.
Though life took Jeffrey Cousins away from West Virginia for a while, as soon as he finished his medical training, he moved to Charleston with his wife and children. The heart surgery unit here at the Charleston Area Medical Center is the closest he could get to the southern coalfields where he grew up. Dr. Cousins prefers using innovative, state-of-the-art surgery techniques and is one of the few surgeons in the state who does beating heart surgery.
Typically and traditionally, heart surgery has been performed with the heart-lung machine, which is a big machine that has a lot of plastic tubing, and you connect the patient to the machine and you kind of stop the heart, and the machine provides the blood flow, oxygen, and what have you during that time. Beating heart surgery, where we eliminate the heart-lung machine, we do not stop the heart, and because of technology and instruments that we have, we're able to do the surgery with the heart beating. And so I think my patients recover a little faster, get back to their normal life a little better, and it eliminates a lot of issues that we develop with the heart-lung machine.
Additionally, Dr. Cousins is one of the pioneers in the United States of robotic heart surgery, or more precisely, robotic-assisted heart surgery. Right now, he's the only person in West Virginia doing it.
What the robot is basically an extension of my hands. We make small incisions, and through these we can put long, skinny instruments. Once we get the instruments in place, we dock the robot next to the patient, and then the robot is connected to a console where I sit down like I'm playing a video game. From the console, we can control through very high-tech and computerized programming. It translates the movement of my hands into these instruments. So when we can do big surgery through tiny incisions, people benefit with a lot less pain, a lot less blood loss, and a lot less time to recover.
When Jeffrey Cousins was 9, his father retired from the coal mines and moved the family to Detroit, where some of Jeffrey's older brothers and sisters lived. There, he won a place at a top public high school and was offered full scholarships both at the Air Force Academy and the University of Pennsylvania. He chose Penn and from there went on to medical school at the University of Michigan. After he finished residencies at St. John's Medical Center in Detroit and the Medical College of Virginia, Cousins returned to West Virginia.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well.
Jeff Cousins came to Charleston as a cardiothoracic surgeon. That's when we met him and fell in love with him.
Dr. Asif Rahman, Chief of Staff at CAMC.
An excellent surgeon and an excellent human being. I mean, the two things that you really need in a physician.
How would you rate him as a cardiothoracic surgeon?
Well, how many stars do we have? 5 stars, 5 stars. 10 stars, 10 stars. So he's way up there. I think he's way up there even at a national level.
After he does a surgery, Dr. Cousins meets with patients' families. He views that time as extremely important.
He's very compassionate.
Patient representative Barbara Patterson.
Most of the time the doctors will talk to the families, but they won't sit down and talk to them. It's like they're talking at them, but not to them. And he gives them an opportunity to ask questions. And I've seen him stay after surgery with a patient. If his patient isn't doing too good, he'll stay with that patient and the family, and he'll constantly come down and talk to them and keep them updated. There's no one like Dr. Cousins. No one like him.
To be able to understand what made Jeffrey Cousins the man he is today, you really need to see his roots in the steep hills and deep hollows of McDowell County.
We're on Route 52 North here, just leaving Mercer County, just coming into McDowell County. And 52 is the main highway that runs down into the southern West Virginia. My Aunt Eleanor used to live here on the left side of the road. Anybody coming in and out of town, in particular related to us, would always stop coming and going. She would always have a nice pack of food and drinks and things for you for the highway when you were leaving town. And she would always give you a little piece of money, as she would say, as well, to help you along your way. Before I was born, she used to run the juke joint. And I think they also used to do a little moonshining from there and some gambling. The next little town here is Keystone. And Keystone is where my father worked in a coal mine for 34 years. And many a morning in the early 70s, we only had one vehicle. And so my mom and I would have to get up and take my dad to work about 5 a.m. or so. And of course, in the evening, we would have to race back so we would be there in time to pick him up. And that's when you would see everybody coming out. You couldn't tell who was black or who was white because everybody was fully covered in coal dust. Both of my grandfathers were coal miners as well.
one interesting story that I always remember about my grandfather, my mother's father, was he was in a tavern over in Blue Well, West Virginia. And during this time, there was still a lot of segregation. And there was a sign supposedly above the bar that says, "No blacks served here." And the bartender had pointed that out to my grandfather. He says, "Hey, you see that sign up there?" And my grandfather's response is, "Yeah, but it don't mean nothing to me because I can't read anyway." And he continued to have his drink and his meals.
Leaving Keystone, we take a narrow dirt road over a mountain, past a huge mountaintop removal mine site, and then arrive in Thorpe, next to Gary, West Virginia. We've come to see Dr. Cousins' 82-year-old aunt, Irene Childress. She's his mother's only surviving sibling. He visits her about once a month and brings any groceries she needs.
Hey.
Hey, baby.
How you doing?
Coming in a junkyard, but I'm old. You can understand it. Lord, I got to get the key.
What okay, no problem.
Her house is in an isolated hollow on a steep hillside, about 30-some rickety steps up.
All right. Doing all right?
Doing pretty good, honey.
Good, good. This is Miss Jean.
Hi, you, Miss Jean.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I told her if anybody knows anything about me that's around, it'd be you. So.
Yeah.
I want to find out what this boy was like when he was a youngster.
He was a good child.
Really?
Never had to beat him. He was a good child all his life.
He wasn't up to orneriness when he was little?
No, ma'am. He was a good child. I mean, he come here good. And he good today. Yes, he is. But I know this is going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or something. He was always helping anybody he could help. He have all of them. Mm-hmm. I love them all so much.
Once we leave Thorpe, we pass through Roth, West Virginia, where his grandparents lived, and then Crumpler, where Jeffrey went to grade school.
Now across this little bridge here, and up on that hill is where my school used to sit, my elementary school, Crumpler Elementary School. Thank God for those teachers, Miss Page, Miss Armstead, Miss Little, and the principal, Miss Adams, and then it became Miss Goosens, but these were all great teachers, and they really cared about us as students, and they really set us on the right path. And now we're coming into McDowell.
Hey, this is McDowell, West Virginia.
This is my hometown. We're going to go through what we call McDowell Bottom and what was also referred to as the White Camp, because this part of the area is where then was predominantly white, and now it's still, I think it's all white people on this area, and where we lived and where the black people still live today is further up the road.
Right there is your house.
Yes. This was my playground all around here. All of we had pigs and chickens and cows and horses and you name it. Now the house is much bigger now than when we lived in it. You can see where there have been some additions. When we were there, we had the front room, the back room, the kitchen, and my mother's bedroom, and that was it. And then later on in life, we got a bathroom built into it. Before that, we had an outhouse that set out back almost by the creek. We had a huge garden all across there as well, and now it's so overgrown you can't even see that there was a road through there.
Did you pretty much feed yourselves from your garden?
Yes. From the garden and also from the animals that we raised. They would slaughter the animals, and there was a smokehouse for curing the meat. That's the slate dump there that we would slide off in the summertime, and that's also the area where my grandfather was crushed by slate when my father was only about 3 years old, way back in about 1922. He was a coal miner as well. Here is where the railroad train ran.
This visit to McDowell County made clear the long and arduous journey Jeffrey Cousins traveled to make it to the top tier of medicine. But it also demonstrates the kind of early nurturing by loving family and neighbors that enables people to make it there.
I actually had a wonderful childhood. There's no reason that I shouldn't be a cardiothoracic surgeon. We saw our parents work hard. We saw the neighbors work hard. And there was a pride that was instilled in each of us. And I think that those basics are the foundation of success anywhere.
As we leave McDowell, we make one last stop at a church on a steep hillside. It looks abandoned.
what's left of Mount Carmel Missionary Baptist Church. This is where I spent Sundays, Wednesdays, and in the summertime every day for vacation Bible school. We were all baptized into the Christian faith here. My father was a deacon here, my mother on the deaconess board, and also sing in the choir. I attribute this place to a lot of my success because it taught me how to behave in public, how to respect other people's space. I learned much about the Bible and public speaking, and many of the things that I use nowadays I learned right here. This is a very special place for me. I guess the bulk of people have died or moved away.
With Dr. Cousins choking back tears, we head back to Charleston.
You could have gone anywhere in the United States to work as a heart surgeon. Why West Virginia?
Primarily, West Virginia is my home. And I love West Virginia, and I love West Virginians. I also feel that there's a need that is here for a West Virginian to be here doing heart surgery. And I think I bring a lot back to West Virginia that other heart surgeons who are not West Virginians can't possibly bring. The understanding, that I always tease the patients and I tell them I'm from McDowell County. And they said, oh, that's amazing. I didn't think. I said, yeah, I speak hillbilly well. You know, and people appreciate that you can communicate with them. And because of my experiences and things with my parents, to me, it's more of a calling and fulfilling a need and being somewhere that I'm appreciated and really carrying out my childhood dreams in my own home.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jean Snedeker.
And since that story originally aired in 2011, Dr. Cousins has moved from CAMC Hospital to St. Mary's in Huntington. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll get to know Summers County native Sylvia Matthews Burwell, the former leader of the Federal Office of the Department of Health and Human Services. We'll be right back.
I feel the shadows now upon me, and red angels beckon me. Before I go, dear Christian brother, won't you come and sing for me?
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing the stories of three native West Virginians who have gone on to become very successful scientists, doctors, and even the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Sylvia Matthews Burwell was one of the first people Jean Snedeker interviewed for the Inspiring West Virginian series back in 2010. Burwell grew up in the small Appalachian town of Hinton, West Virginia, not too far from where I live. Let's listen to the story.
Madam President, I come today and I'm honored to support my friend, Sylvia Matthews Burwell. Sylvia is a native of West Virginia, and I always said this, we are all products of our environment. If you know where Sylvia came from, the type of family she was raised in, the neighborhood, her friends, it'll tell you everything about who she is today and why she's been so successful and why public service runs through her veins, truly giving something back.
Senator Joe Manchin, speaking before the Senate in June 2014, on the day the Senate voted to confirm Sylvia Matthews Burwell as the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. In the previous year, she served as the director of the Office of Management and Budget. In the previous decade, Burwell was in the business of giving money away to some of the world's poorest people, most recently at the Walmart Foundation, and before that with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle, which is where I met her for the inaugural series of Inspiring West Virginians.
We're in my office in Seattle, and our offices are located on Lake Union. And so the view out of my office is of Lake Union. There's some ship repair that goes on right outside of my office, and you can also see other parts of Seattle from here.
A city built around water. Seattle is the home of Amazon.com, numerous Boeing aircraft factories, the software giant Microsoft, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the world's largest charitable organization.
You can also see to the right to where the houseboats are. Those are the actual houseboats that people live in here on the water in Seattle.
Dressed in a sweater, jeans, and fashionable boots, 44-year-old Sylvia Matthews Burwell could pass for a college student. A native of Summers County, West Virginia, Matthews Burwell's youthful looks belie the huge responsibilities she carries in helping millions of people in the developing world.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is founded on the idea that all lives have equal value. And from that, what we hope to do is ensure that all children have the opportunity to lead a healthy and productive life. And then we have chosen areas of focus because we believe that focus is the best way to achieve impact and results, that are places where we think there's a great need and that we think we can add tremendous value.
Here in the United States, the Gates Foundation focuses on education, especially improving the quality of education in American high schools. In their global health work, they concentrate on diseases of the developing world such as HIV, malaria, polio, and tuberculosis. Sylvia Matthews Burwell is president of Global Development. They help small farmers increase productivity and provide access to financial services as well as safe, clean water for the poor.
2.5 billion people in the world do not have sanitation. And for people in West Virginia, where even when I was growing up, there were still certain developments in rural parts of the state, that's something I'm sure people understand why that is so important to both health and quality of life.
The budget for global development is $750 million a year. By any standard, it's a monumental task. But Sylvia's colleague, Alan Goldston, president of the foundation's work here in the United States, believes if anyone can do it, Sylvia can.
First, I would say she is one of the smartest people that I've ever met. And she's one of the most humble people, ethical, integrity. So her values, she is a very values-driven individual, which I appreciate. Very focused, knows how to get results. So, you know, you match that unbelievable intellect with just real grounded values.
The building now to the right is where we went to Central Grade School. Also had Hinton Junior High and had Hinton High School.
This is where you all were studying hard.
Yes, we were.
Those grounded values started here in Hinton, West Virginia, on the banks of the New River in Summers County. In a busy Kirk's restaurant where Sylvia Matthews had her first job, I meet longtime friend Christy Scott.
Sylvia and I met when we first started in the public school system at age 5. We played together constantly. We lived one block apart, and we would go to each other's houses, roller skate. Typical, wonderful childhood things. We have been best friends for almost 40 years. Just want to show you how close. These are the alleys.
Yes.
Sylvia and I would ride our bicycles in. And Sylvia's house is right up here.
The daughter of Greek parents and the younger of two sisters, Sylvia Matthews grew up in a close extended family of grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends.
All four of my grandparents immigrated from Greece to West Virginia at various times and points. On my mother's side, my grandfather came and settled in Williamson, West Virginia. My grandfather came first and had written letters and met his wife through writing. Proposed to her through the letters, and her father brought her from a small village in Greece to Paris, and that is where they met and were married. And the first time he actually met her face-to-face is when he married her.
This Williamson grandfather came to work in the mines, and the Hinton one to work on the railroad, but they both ended up in the food business. One ran a restaurant and the other a sweet shop. From all accounts, Sylvia had a happy, fun-loving childhood.
Oh. From my perspective, it was great growing up in Hinton in the early 70s and 80s. It is an incredible community. Lots of different activities, like the sports activities. My father and one of his best friends taught us the old game of tin can winker, and we would have great matches in the backyard, badminton in the backyard, croquet in the backyard. My father taught us to paint with oils. Got my sister Stephanie and I a set, and we learned to paint. Lots of neighbors and engagement with people there. I spent lots of time at our neighbors next door, Margie and Hank. My mother was president of the Ascension Church Women for over 25 years. My father was in the Lions Club. He was in the Elks Club. Christy and I would have to, and my sister Stephanie, we would have to do trick-or-treat for UNICEF before we could go trick-or-treating.
This commitment to public service continues. More recently, Sylvia's mother, Cleo Matthews, served on the State Board of Education and is mayor of Hinton. Sylvia, too, started in public life very young. When she was 8, she led a campaign to elect Christie's father county commissioner, and at 11, covered Jay Rockefeller's first campaign for governor of West Virginia.
We had started a small newspaper called the Central News and World Report, and we were reporters, and we were granted the first interview with candidate Jay Rockefeller when he arrived at the Memorial Building to do a speech to the people of Summers County about his campaign.
Christy Scott had hopes it would be the beginning of a long and successful political career for her good friend.
I told Sylvia in grade school that she would be our first female president. I'm still holding out for that. I think that might still come true.
My family instilled in me the idea of trying hard, and that was the more important thing than whether you succeeded or failed. The measure was, and the value was, giving something your best effort.
Sylvia's best efforts paid off. She was valedictorian of the class of 1983 at Hinton High School, then followed her older sister Stephanie to Harvard University, graduating with honors in government. She won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford University in England, earning a second degree in politics, philosophy, and economics. And then after college, Sylvia joined the New York offices of McKinsey & Company, a global management consultancy firm where she worked for financial services clients such as American Express. At the age of 27, Matthews took a leave of absence from McKinsey to work on Bill Clinton's campaign for president, becoming a key player in the economic team. Afterward, she stayed on in the Clinton administration, first at the National Economic Council based at the White House, then chief of staff to Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, then to the West Wing itself.
When I came back and was deputy chief of staff to the president, it was a unique opportunity to just sit and see what the executive of the United States has to handle and do on a day-to-day basis, just the incredible volume.
In her final 3 years in the Clinton administration, Matthews was number 2 at the Office of Management and Budget, the agency that draws up the annual federal budget of income and expenditure.
If we turn a little bit, you can see, and it's the furthest budget in that bookshelf. Those are the budgets of the U.S. government, and yeah. You will see the black budget. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that I was a part of balancing the budget for the United States government. We had a surplus. We paid down the national debt. We started creating more space and room for long-term payments for entitlements, for Social Security, for Medicare. But it was the first time in an extremely long time that we as a nation did not spend more than we took in. And I'm very proud of being at the Office of Management and Budget in the year when that happened.
It didn't last too long, though, that surplus.
Sadly, the surplus did not last.
But her close eye on expenditure has lasted. At the multi-billion-dollar Gates Foundation, Matthews Burwell has earned a reputation for keeping costs under control. And colleague Alan Goldston is amazed at the creative ways she does it.
One of the things she wanted to do is to make us more efficient in our operating costs and to cause us to just recognize that every dollar we spend on pencils or on things that don't matter to the work is a dollar that doesn't go to a vaccine or to agriculture or to educational change. And the way she did it is she created this fun campaign called Beans and Weenies. And what that meant was, hey, if we need paper, we don't need the best paper. If we're going to have a lunch, working lunch, we don't need the nice sandwiches. Let's get the pizza or the beans and weenies. And so the whole organization came around that and it became competitive. What's the least amount we can spend on something and still get it done? And I mean, you just saw that translate into a culture change, and Sylvia made it great.
In 2005, the Wall Street Journal named Sylvia Matthews one of the 50 women to watch worldwide. That same year, she met the man who would become her husband.
I am incredibly blessed to have found a fabulous, fabulous husband. My husband, Stephen Burwell, a terrific partner and friend, and is an incredible blessing that was, as my girlfriends tell me, was well worth the wait. And then we've been blessed with a daughter who is 2 years old and is just more fun than anything else in our lives.
And their daughter has recently been joined by a little brother.
Hold me close, close, dear mother. Hug me with your arms so tight.
Are you surprised you ended up here? A little girl from Hinton, West Virginia.
Yes, I think there have been many times that I have been surprised about where I am and when and how. I can remember once I was with President Clinton and we were standing on top of a building in Moscow. There were fireworks because it was the 50th anniversary of some of the transitions post-World War II. And beautiful fireworks are going off all around us. And President Clinton turns to me and he says, Sylvia, we are a long way from Hope and Hinton.
Despite Christie's childhood predictions, Sylvia Matthews Burwell has no current plans to run for president. She is, however, in charge of 70,000 people at the Department of Health and Human Services, with a budget in excess of $1 trillion. But Sylvia still calls her childhood friends every week, and she also has a message for youngsters growing up in West Virginia today.
It is an incredible thing to be from our state and to be proud of it. I spout my 8th grade West Virginia history on a regular basis because I am so proud of being from a place where I think so many very important values of hard work, respect, sense of community are instilled, and the importance of friendships. What I think we sometimes lose in urban settings, sitting on the porch and having the conversation. And I think having the ability to have those things, it's an incredible gift.
At the end of your life, what do you hope people will say?
She contributed, she learned, she had fun.
I heard someone call my name.
That was Sylvia Matthews Burwell, the former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services under the Obama administration. She was recently hired for another prestigious job, the President of American University in Washington, D.C. That story was produced by Jean Snediger and was part of the Inspiring West Virginian series. You can listen to all of these stories from this series on our website at wvpublic.org. Final story, we're going to travel to Amish country to hear about one of the most unusual medical clinics in the United States. The Clinic for Special Children in Strasburg, Pennsylvania, founded by Dr. D. Holmes Morton. Morton has a very unusual story for such a successful career in medicine. The Fayetteville, West Virginia native was a high school dropout. Here's Gene Snediger again with his profile.
Midnight, January 15th. 1997. Half asleep, I'm waiting for amino acids to finish running. A blood sample was brought in by a hired driver from 100 miles away, a sample from a new baby who has maple syrup urine disease. He's not ill, and because of timely diagnosis, he can be easily treated.
Tucked among the fertile cornfields and pastures of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, is a highly unusual medical practice called the Clinic for Special Children. The clinic stands on 2.5 acres at the end of a long lane, smack dab in the middle of an Amish farm. As the farmer spreads manure on his alfalfa field outside, inside, Dr. Holmes Morton chats on the phone with another doctor about a young patient.
Referred by Dr. Clommers, you're right. This is done,
Donna. We had the gene mutation.
Nearly every patient here is a child with a debilitating genetic disorder.
He is the fourth child for these young parents, their first son, the second of their children with the disease. His mother is 25 years old and has four children, two with this disease. How much of the next 20 years of her life will be given to this child and his trouble? How many hours of my life will he claim?
In the parking lot are two hitching posts for horses and buggies. But this clinic is a world-renowned medical facility. Here, doctors and scientists diagnose and treat rare genetic disorders in Old Order Amish and Mennonite children. These children often have physical and mental disabilities, which appear to be cerebral palsy, but aren't. The communities call these youngsters God's special children.
These children are seen as important to the culture and the community through your efforts to help these children, that they teach you things that are helpful in other ways.
I always think of that as I examine a newborn with maple syrup urine disease or glutaric aciduria or Crigler-Najjar disease. Each child takes, needs, defines another piece of my life. A few more hours away from nights and holidays, a few less hours of needed rest or reading, or writing, or playing the cello. Meaningful work, yes, no doubt. What I know, what I learn, does help these children. Child by child, hour by hour, as I am needed, my future is taken, decided, shaped. Was that part of the cost of coming here, searching for, seeing meaningful work? Was that the ultimate cost of looking into the eyes of such children?
Holmes Morton, reading a letter he wrote to a young medical student in 1997. The following year, he picked up a cello for the first time. The Clinic for Special Children was founded 21 years ago by Holmes from Fayetteville, West Virginia, and his wife Caroline from Beckley. And today, this couple are among the few outsiders who have been embraced by the Plain People, that is, Old Order Amish and Mennonites who usually live separate from mainstream society. 300 years ago, in search of religious freedom, these communities came to the United States from Germany and Switzerland, and they brought with them inherited disorders that continue to this day. But how in the world did a high school dropout from West Virginia become the world's leading authority on genetic-based diseases of the Plain People, whose life and work has been documented by the Smithsonian, Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times? Well, according to Holmes Morton, it's the journey of a man in search of meaningful work. And it's a reminder that it's never too late.
I grew up in the town of Fayetteville in the southern coalfields of West Virginia. Family had a home there that we moved into when I was about 1 or 2 years old, and that's where we always were. We still go back there. My brother owns the house now and has restored it. Growing up in a town like Fayetteville gives you a different, I think, a sense of security or something. Everybody knows everybody. I think you also grow up with a sense you're being watched. So the town cop knew who we were, and if we got in trouble, he was pretty quick to come down to the house and talk to Dad about it.
The third of four brothers, Holmes Morton's father, Paul Morton, was a coal miner who later became a mining engineer. His mother was a housewife, artist, and amateur golfer. Though he liked to study subjects he was interested in, Holmes didn't like school much, and he didn't do well. His brother Charlie remembers when his parents decided to send him to private school.
Mom swears when he went to Virginia Episcopal School over in Lynchburg in the ninth grade that he was a very slow reader and not a very good student. But he got to be an avid reader, and he's very much self-taught. He was always outdoorsy. He did some fishing and trapping of mink and I guess beaver and whatnot locally, and he would skin those and sell the pelts somewhere. So he's always been very outdoorsy, but not much of a student.
From my perspective, I was a good student. I studied a variety of things. I was very interested in literature, and at times I would be interested in mathematics, and at times I would be interested in music. The only problem was what I studied never really matched what was going on in school. So from the perspective of my teachers, I was at best an erratic student. I wasn't much bothered by not doing well on tests and having low grades.
Is it true that you flunked all your science classes in high school?
Most of them, yes.
In the spring of his senior year in high school, Holmes Morton dropped out, thinking he wanted to become a writer. He went to work as a boiler man in the engine room of an ore boat on the Great Lakes. 2 years later, he was drafted and did the same job in the engine room of naval ships.
I just happened to read an article in Scientific American about the asymmetry of function in the nervous system, that language was located on the left side and music was located on the right side. And I realized that I didn't know much about the brain. And that led to a long period of just studying psychology and neurology and reading about what was known about the nervous system, all sort of done independently while floating around on ships.
In his mid-20s, Morton decided to apply to Trinity College in Connecticut, which had an independent study program. And based on a research paper he'd written purely out of interest, they let him in. Right before he left for college, Holmes visited his parents and met Caroline Smith, a fellow West Virginian. I first met her next to a noisy West Virginia stream.
I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia, where my mother was also born and grew up, so we go back several generations in the Beckley area.
Caroline grew up in a tradition of providing health care to rural families. For more than 50 years, her grandfather, McCrae Banks, was a physician in the coal camp Raleigh, right outside of Beckley. And her father, who was known as Pinky Smith, was a family doctor who cared for people from birth to death.
I remember as a child going on house calls, sometimes good distances in the country, to visit families. So it was an important part of my growing up, visiting my grandfather's office in the middle of the coal camp. And he took care of many families for many years.
After college, Caroline worked for the Red Cross in Vietnam and later trained teachers for the Head Start program in West Virginia. And while Holmes and Caroline were both studying in New England, these two West Virginians from the southern coal fields started dating and married in 1979. While he was in college, Holmes became interested in children with neurological problems and applied to Harvard Medical School. To everyone's surprise, not least his own, he got in. After Harvard, Morton trained in pediatrics in Boston and continued research in genetic disorders at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. It was here one of the major turning points in his life took place. In the summer of 1988, while working in a genetics lab, Morton analyzed a sample from an Amish child with a disease called glutaric aciduria type 1.
Which produces a injury of the nervous system that looks like cerebral palsy. We had never seen that disease at Children's in Philadelphia. It was thought to be a very rare disease. So I just simply drove out to examine the child and talk to the family and learn something more about the disease.
Here he reads from an account he wrote of the Amish mother's experience.
We hoped he was not like our others. He seemed all right. He sat up, walked when he should have. But then it happened. He was 18 months old. He had a cold and a fever. He seemed tired, so I put him down for a nap after lunch. When I checked on him 2 hours later, he was helpless. He couldn't hold his head or swallow. He couldn't sit. No strength was left. We knew then he was like the others. There was no other reason for it. Amos and I just sat together and cried for a long time. We took him to the doctor. We knew the doctor would send us to the hospital, but we knew that after all the pain and the tests and the money, there wouldn't be any answers.
I was also convinced by the end of that summer that injury was probably preventable, because the children were well when they were born and would often go 6 months or a year or 18 months before they showed any signs of disability. And often the injury was abrupt. They would go from being a healthy child in the morning to fully disabled by afternoon. For somebody who works in this area, that is the hallmark of a treatable disease.
After being turned down for a research grant by the National Institutes of Health, Holmes and Caroline Morton decided to open a research and treatment clinic right where the patients lived, in Lancaster County. But at that point, Holmes didn't have a job, and they had no money. To raise funds, they considered taking out a second mortgage on their house, when an article appeared about them in the Wall Street Journal. It captured the attention of people around the country. Money poured in. Hewlett-Packard donated laboratory equipment worth $250,000. A year later, on a rainy day in November, 60 Amish carpenters and farmers raised the clinic in one day.
It was exciting. It was overwhelming.
A little overwhelming, yeah. We had about 100 people for lunch down at the farmhouse.
Very traditional building process that begins early in the morning and ends when they all have to go home and milk the cows.
I think the important thing for us was it involved the community in a way that we felt helped make a statement about the fact that the clinic was really there for the community, and that ultimately they own it.
One day in September, for the last 20 years, 7,000 Amish and Mennonite people gather for an annual auction to benefit the clinic. They arrive by horse and buggy, by bicycle, in wheelchairs, and on foot. Hundreds of horses and buggies line the parking lots. Everything auctioned, quilts, household goods, and furniture, not to mention the food, are donated by Mennonite and Amish families.
This is a remarkable experience. I think it's also an example of what this community does, not just for us, but for people within the community who have special health care needs and special problems.
Throughout the day, parents and children approach Dr. Morton just to say thanks for what he's done for them. And on this one day, a third of the clinic's annual budget is raised.
It's a very important fundraiser for us, but I think more important for the community, it's a reunion for families who have children with these problems. And there are a lot of outsiders here that learn a lot about what it means to live in a community with support like this.
The ideas that Holmes and Caroline considered when setting up the clinic, things like home visits, on-site research and testing, practicing where the patients live, were based on what Caroline grew up with in West Virginia, the way her father and grandfather practiced medicine.
The model of the clinic for special children is really a very old model of health care. It really looks at the physician as the physician scientist who is not only taking care of patients and families in the context of their daily lives, but also trying to solve scientific problems as they do that.
One scientific problem that Morton and his team did figure out was how to prevent the worst effects of glutaric aciduria type 1 in the Amish and maple syrup urine disease in Mennonite children. For the first 2 years of life, if children are put on a low-protein diet and given glucose often, they tend not to have the strokes that lead to serious disabilities.
By the time the children are 18 to 24 months of age, the brain is much less vulnerable to that injury. So we've never had a patient here or anywhere in the world injured by one of these strokes after 2 years of age.
For their work in bringing world-class genetic medicine to a place where people need it most, Holmes Morton and the Clinic for Special Children have been given a number of awards. Time magazine named Morton a hero of medicine. The MacArthur Foundation awarded him a genius grant, $500,000 to carry on his research. He's also received the Albert Schweitzer Humanitarian Award. And Holmes hasn't forgotten his home state. Every summer, for the last 24 years, this high school dropout comes back to West Virginia to speak to future scientists at the National Youth Science Camp held in Pocahontas County. And as a family, being from West Virginia holds a special importance.
Our roots are very important to both of us. Whenever people ask where I'm from, I say, well, I'm really from West Virginia, although I've lived in Pennsylvania for the last 25 years. It's always, I'm originally from West Virginia. Even though our children weren't born in West Virginia, we feel like they have West Virginia blood that is important to them.
I do very much see it as my roots, and I see that small town as, you know, fostering a curiosity and a kind of stubbornness, I think, that has allowed me to do a lot that I wouldn't have been able to do.
Have you found the meaningful work you were searching for?
Yes.
That story was produced by Jean Snediger. Last summer, Dr. Morton left the clinic for special children in Strasburg. He started a new clinic in central Pennsylvania, and now even more Amish and Mennonite folks can be treated closer to home. He left the clinic for special children in good hands, though, as his longtime colleague, Dr. Kevin Strauss, is now running it. Morton's brother, Paul, is the executive director of the new clinic. A special thanks to Jean Snediger and Suzanne Higgins for their help with this episode. As West Virginians, we often have a tendency to self-deprecate as we deal with the aftermath of some harsh stereotypes. Thank you, Jean and Suzanne, for this series. These stories, like yours, are truly inspiring. You can listen to the full series of Inspiring West Virginians on our website at wvpublic.org. And until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Inspiring West Virginians, which was produced by Jean Snediger and West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Suzanne Higgins. The Inspiring West Virginians series was made possible by the Miles Family Foundation, Inspiring West Virginians to Soar. Music in today's show was provided by D. Holmes Morton and Paul Holmes Morton, Ed Bowes, Jerry Milnes, John Gallagher, W.G. Snuffy Walden, Dinosaur Burps, Roma Yagnick, Ben Townsend, and Anna and Elizabeth. Patrick Stevens is our audio mixer. Roxy Todd is our producer. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.